This is Melissa, and today is August 11, 2024, and I hope that everyone is doing all right. I had said earlier in the week, a couple of days ago, as a matter of fact, that I was going to put up a short redux, and I'll do the best that I can to do that, because I was pressed for time. But earlier in the week, I was listening to the beginning of a talk that Alan gave August 2, 2020, entitled All Hail Capcom, Capitalists Finance Communists to Bring in Equality, For Technocrats the Good Life, For Proles Mediocrity. And I thought that the first section of this would be good. It's worth hearing again, for sure. But as the week went on, things happened in the world, and I had things on my mind, and so I'm not sure how much my intro will tie in with what I've chosen. But there are some things that I wanted to bring to your attention. And the first is this latest Israeli strike on a Gaza school that killed nearly 100, and that just happened today. I'm recording this late Saturday night. An Israeli strike on a school sheltering displaced Palestinians killed at least 93 people in the Gaza Strip on Saturday, civil defense authorities said, in one of the single deadliest bombings of the months-long war, amid a U.S.-led attempt to push Israel and Hamas toward a long-delayed ceasefire deal. Gaza civil defense spokesman Mahmoud Basal said the Al-Tabain school in Gaza City was housing about 6,000 displaced Palestinians when the bomb struck around 4:30 a.m. He said at least 11 children and 6 women were among those killed, with at least 54 injured and dozens missing. Video from the scene shows scores of bodies wrapped in sheets and blankets laid in the schoolyard after the strike as women crouched over corpses in grief. Basal said the toll, with many of the bodies charred and unidentifiable, was expected to rise. The recovery operations are indescribable. And I will say that I stumbled on some footage of the rescue operations and some of the charred and maimed bodies that they're talking about here, and it's horrific. This is from the 8th of August. Israel and the U.S. prepare for a series of scenarios, including a potential Hezbollah attack. We won't tolerate attacks on our citizens, said an Israeli defense official. The Israeli military is working in close coordination with the Pentagon to prepare for a series of scenarios in which either Iran or one of its proxies, namely Hezbollah, could launch an attack or series of attacks against Israel, an Israeli defense official told ABC News. Both Iran and its Lebanese proxy group, Hezbollah, have vowed to take revenge against Israel for 2 assassinations carried out in Beirut and Tehran last week, which killed Fuad Shukr, a senior Hezbollah commander, and Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh, respectively. Israel has not claimed responsibility for Haniyeh's death. The Israeli official who spoke with ABC News on condition of anonymity suggested one red line for Israel, which could ratchet up tensions, would be an attack that harms or targets Israeli civilians. We don't have an interest in a war or escalation, the Israeli defense official said, but we won't tolerate attacks on our citizens. The defensive preparations being made by Israel in conjunction with the United States were very critical, the official said. What we are seeing is the U.S. taking a very clear position in their actions and their messaging, and it matters, the Israeli defense official told ABC. In the wake of the assassinations, the Pentagon has announced it is moving two additional naval destroyers and a squadron of F-22 Raptor fighter jets into the eastern Mediterranean as part of efforts to bolster defenses in and around Israel. In an unusual step, U.S. officials also said a squadron of F-18 fighter jets from the aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt were being redeployed to an undisclosed airbase in the Middle East. The Israeli defense officials said these redeployments of American military assets, which were aimed at defending Israel, appear to be unprecedented in scale and scope. The Biden administration has also been talking to regional allies about efforts to defend Israel from a potential Iranian attack. However, U.S. diplomats told ABC News earlier this week they were facing a steeper hurdle convincing partners in the region to rejoin the defensive coalition, which rallied to protect Israel from attacks by more than 300 Iranian drones and missiles back in April. Many international partners see some of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's actions, particularly the killing of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Iran, as unnecessarily provocative. Although Israel has not claimed responsibility for Haniyeh's death, neither has it denied that it carried out the assassination in the Iranian capital. Israel did claim responsibility for the strike on Beirut that killed Fuad Shukr. Iran's Revolutionary Guard said in a statement released on Saturday that Israel would face severe punishment for the assassination, which they said would come at an appropriate time and place. I found something from a few days ago in the Jewish Press. It's jewishpress.com. Israel, U.S., and allies ready for Iranian axis of evil. Okay, it's an axis of evil. That's a propaganda term. We've heard, I think the first time I heard the axis was Ronald Reagan, but George W. Bush certainly talked about the axis of evil. Israel defense forces are deployed and holding steady at high alert on every border in the country. Israelis nationwide have stockpiled 3 days' supplies of water and food, candy for their children, extra power banks for their cell phones, and comfortable accommodations in their in-home bomb shelters. That's nice that they have that, isn't it? I don't think the Palestinians have comfortable accommodations in their in-home bomb shelters. I'll put this up. It's quite lengthy. It's a lot of bad Iran and the threat that Israel is under, etc., etc. I found a site that I had not seen before called Presenza, International Press Agency. Here's a little bit about Presenza. Humanism, nonviolence, human rights, disarmament, diversity. Presenza is a space open to the expression of the social base. We endorse a universalist humanist perspective and actively promote cooperation agreements and partnerships with other agencies, as well as reciprocal links with portals, platforms, news, and communication media of specific communities and cultures. Presenza consists of volunteers with extensive experience in communication, social activism, cultural, and academic fields. The agency is independent from any economic interest, the basic condition for its autonomy. Presenza gives visibility to news, initiatives, proposals, and scenarios related to peace, nonviolence, disarmament, human rights, and the fight against all forms of discrimination. Now, I want to point out a couple of things here. Generally, when someone says that they are a humanist, there is a separation there from a religious identification. And I just want to say that humanism itself is a kind of religion. But when you look at the insanity that is involved in the more militaristic aspects of Zionism and Christian Zionism and end times Gog and Magog. And just to update you here, if I can find it again, I was looking at a video earlier this afternoon that a rabbi put out where he was talking about Gog and Magog. And immediately after this happened, this current war started in October of last year, I pointed out the apocalyptic end time scenario that was potential in this. The Gog and Magog, the revelation, the end time scenarios. And that rhetoric is definitely still being whipped up by both Christian pastors of various sects and Jewish rabbis. And there are, you can find all kinds of people talking about it, but if I can stumble upon this one rabbi, I'll link to it, because it was a very succinct explanation of a point of view that is pretty scary. But I found this Presenza because they do a lot of reporting that is against war. And I think that those of you who've listened to Alan Watt for many years will understand that Alan would not be called a peacenik or an anti-war protester, but, you know, that he wouldn't be identified in a group like that. But he was very much against war. And to cut right to the chase, to get right to the point of it, is because when you are ruled, when you are a slave in an ancient system, and wars are for reasons that we will never be told the truth about, always resources to be sure, but always for reasons that we will never be told the truth about. And Alan knew this. This is why he would say, don't be a joiner, don't join anything. Young men, don't allow yourselves to be, you know, he did not want young men to allow themselves to be radicalized. He would point out the intelligence agencies that were often behind this kind of radicalization. And in his, in Alan's voluminous body of work that we are all so grateful exists, he was always pointing us in the direction of who is behind this, what groups are behind the wars that are fought, the resource acquisition, what's the real history, what is the true story that we're looking at, because time and time again, we are given propaganda. We're given, you know, there's the reason and there's the real reason. Well, all we ever get is the reason, never the real reason. And so he didn't want to see people used for wars that really, in truth, had nothing to do with them. So in this Presenza website, I found a document. And this was just released right now. It's August of 2024. And it's entitled, Welcome to Hell. The Israeli Prison System as a Network of Torture Camps. We were taken to Megiddo. When we got off the bus, a soldier said to us, Welcome to Hell. From the testimony of Fuad Hassan, 45, a father of five and a resident of a town in the Nablus district who was held in Megiddo prison. This document talks about the prison protocols, overpopulation and crowding in the cells, no sunlight, no air to breathe, roll call, cell searches, denying access to and contact with the outside world, restrictions on religious worship, confiscation of personal possessions, living in darkness. Physical and psychological abuse, including physical violence and intimidation, sleep deprivation, violence during transfers, sexual violence. absence and denial of medical treatment, food deprivation and starvation, cutting off the water supply, cold, etc. Since the horrific Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on 7 October 2023, we have been hearing every day of more and more crimes and atrocities that would have been unthinkable in the not-too-distant past. Tens of thousands of civilians killed, entire neighborhoods obliterated, over a million people turned refugees in one fell swoop, civilians taken hostage and held as bargaining chips. In the West Bank, settler violence is surging, a massive expulsion of Palestinian communities is underway, and violence by Israeli armed forces is rampant. Countless human-made disasters that the mind cannot countenance and the heart cannot contain. Amidst this tragic reality, state mechanisms are undergoing terrifying systemic changes in a cynical exploitation of the loss, fear, and vengefulness sweeping the country. I am going to post this, Welcome to Hell, and the conditions that are described here. Particularly, I give a warning of the sexual torture that is done to prisoners. It's very terrible. It's horrific. I'm also going to post another piece that comes from Presenza. It's three 18-year-old conscientious objectors sentenced to 30 days in prison for refusing to enlist in the Israeli army. Yuval Moav was sentenced on Monday. Orion Mueller from Tel Aviv was sentenced on Tuesday, and Itamar Greenberg was sentenced on Wednesday. All three are being sent to military prison. They are expected to be tried repeatedly for several months. From Yuval Moav's refusal statement, "To my Palestinian brothers and sisters, in my simple act, I want to stand in solidarity with you. I know that every child in Gaza is forced to be a bigger hero than I will ever be. I know that there are kids younger than me in Israeli prisons, for no fault of their own, whose pain I could never know. I also acknowledge that I do not represent the majority opinion in my society, but in my action, I hope to raise the voice of those of us who are waiting for the day we can build a joint future, build a society based on peace and equality and not occupation and apartheid." In his refusal statement, Itamar Greenberg wrote, "I grew up in a Haredi household in Bnei Brak. When I was 12, I decided that I would enlist to the IDF to become a real part of Israeli society. I didn't want to be a soldier, but I wanted to be an Israeli. Now that I'm 18, I know that the fact that the door into Israeli society goes through the oppression and killing of another people is a grave injustice in our society. A just society cannot be built on gun barrels." And from Orion Mueller's refusal statement, "Vengeance is the primary mechanism behind the cycle of blood, and the war in Gaza is the most extreme way the state of Israel takes advantage of the urge for revenge to advance oppression and death in Israel, Palestine. The struggle against the war is not enough. We must fight the structural mechanisms enabling it. Systemic racism within Israel, the apartheid military regime managed right by in the West Bank, the rise of violent and militaristic extremism among the Jewish population of Israel, the settlement industry, and many other factors." Someone accused me recently of wanting, you know, be it on me to live amongst bloodthirsty Muslim refugees and immigrants and so forth, and by defending Palestinians. I think the point of what I'm saying, the point of what Alan was always saying, is know your enemy. Identify your enemy. Do I want to live under Sharia law? No. Or look at what's happening in Ireland right now. And there are people in Ireland who are being victimized, not just by having many more refugees flood into their country than the country can absorb, but because young Irish men do not know who their real enemy is. And here's something from the Irish News. 3 in 5 people believe Ireland has taken in too many refugees. So this is just a poll, right? There's not much here except a poll. This marks an increase of 6% on the same figures from February 2023. The results of the survey, which were produced by Ireland Thinks for the Sunday Independent, come after anti-immigration protests turned violent in Coolock, northern Dublin, last month. More than 19 people were arrested after protesters began attacking Garda officers at a disused factory designated as accommodation for asylum seekers. Anti-immigration protesters from Coolock were also involved in far-right demonstrations in Belfast at the weekend. However, the latest poll revealed that almost the same amount of people, 59%, disagreed with those protesting outside migrant accommodations. In addition, while housing, immigration, and the cost of living were identified as the 3 most important issues for those surveyed, the rise of the far right is now ranked as the 4th most important priority to deal with. Elsewhere, almost 3/4 of people support Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald's policy that refugees and asylum seekers should be housed in more affluent areas of the country. This is from yesterday, August 9, Friday. First men jailed for riot-related social media posts. Jordan Parler was sentenced to 20 months in jail for urging people to target a hotel housing asylum seekers and refugees. Shortly after, Tyler Kay was also jailed for his own post calling for hotels housing asylum seekers to be set alight. The first jail terms for using social media to encourage disorder in the recent unrest have been handed down. Jordan Parler is believed to be the first person to be sent to prison over social media posts made in relation to the nationwide riots. Unrest erupted after online posts falsely identified the suspected killer of 3 young girls in a knife attack in Southport. Parler was sentenced to 20 months in prison at Leeds Crown Court after pleading guilty to publishing written material intended to stir racial hatred. His mother submitted a note to court saying, "We can only speculate that he has been caught up and swept away by emotions circulating around the country." The 28-year-old wrote that every man and his dog should smash the F out of Britannia Hotel in Leeds in a Facebook post in early August. So early August was last week, and he's already been tried and sent to prison. And the article goes on. I will post it. And these are the stories that Alan really hated to hear, because these young men do not know who their real enemy is. So the section that I am playing is the very first part of the August 2, 2020 talk. And on a redux last year, just about a year ago, I replayed a different section of this talk that was from August 20, 2023, and I entitled it, "Who is in Charge?" And at that time, I was talking about Victoria Nuland, Project for the New American Century, and the Aspen Institute. So it was about a year ago that I had really dug into the Aspen Institute and warmongering that really that seems to be the purpose of the Aspen Institute. So there may be a little bit of overlap. I started on that redux right at a point where Alan said this, "And the people who go into certain areas are more devious than anybody else. Higher up in governmental levels and corporation levels, all they do is sit and scheme how to get more and how to manipulate and how to take and how to demolish competition all the time as well. You talk about the billions of dollars that are going to all your intelligence agencies every year. Billions and billions, multiple billions of dollars in every country to find ways to scheme and to lie and to deceive other nations and their own people by different techniques and so on. Persuasion and lies and so on, so that those who own you can take more from you or take more resources from countries. That's why they go to war with countries. It's all economics. Marx was right in that wars, the root of all wars was economics. It's materialism, stealing, you know. Yep, we steal it because we want it. So I am starting at the beginning of this talk, and like I said, there might be a little bit of overlap. But I wanted to mention that I will have to edit some of what Alan said. Remember, this he's talking in August of 2020. And so when I put it up for the YT channel, I will have edited. And if you want to hear everything Alan said, I'll, of course, you know, you can go to August 2, 2020 on the website or find it someplace else. But right about right now, when I get to editing, I am going to plug in an audio video clip of a woman who just passed away on August 9. Yesterday, by the name of Susan Wojcicki. Susan Wojcicki was an American business executive who is the chief executive officer of YouTube from 2014 to 2023. Interestingly, they tell us right off the top that her net worth was estimated at $765 million in 2022. She passed away yesterday, leaving a husband and five children, and many other grieving friends and relatives behind. I'm going to plug in that clip where she was speaking with Fortune Editor-in-Chief Alison Chantel at the 2022 World Economic Forum in Davos. She discusses the challenges of regulating the content it publishes on the site and that it recommends to users.
We're definitely investing a huge amount to make sure that we're fighting misinformation, and there are a number of different ways that we look at this. So the first would be, from a policy standpoint, we would look at content that we would think about in terms of being violative of our policies. So if you look at COVID, for example, we came up with 10 different policies that we said would be violative. Like, an example of that would be saying that COVID came from something other than a virus. And we did see people attacking 5G equipment, for example, because they thought that it was causing COVID. And so that would just be an example of a policy that we'd remove. So we do remove content based on those policies. We actually publish that in a transparency report. The second one would be really raising up authoritative information. So if you are dealing with a sensitive subject like news, health, science, we are going to make sure that what we're recommending is coming from a trusted, well-known publisher that can be reliable. And if you think about how Google works, it's very similar. Like, if you type in cancer or you type in COVID, what you're going to get are going to be names that you recognize. They're not going to be someone that just published a web page yesterday. So it's very similar with regard to how we handle that on YouTube. The third is making sure that we, if there's content that's borderline content that technically meets our policy but is lower quality, that's content that we basically will not recommend to our users. Our users could still access it, but they will not recommend it. And then lastly, we're just really careful about what we monetize. So we always want to make sure that there's no incentive. So, for example, with regard to climate change, we don't monetize any kind of climate change material. So there's no incentive for you to keep publishing that material that is propagating something that is generally understood as not accurate information.
Okay, so now you've all heard that clip. Susan Wojcicki, who helped turn Google from a startup in her garage into an internet juggernaut and who became one of Silicon Valley's most prominent female executives with her leadership of YouTube died on Friday. She was 56. So I'll post different articles, and what you will find, the foundational myth story is that she rented out her garage to Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the founders of Google, 1998. She charged them $1,700 a month to use the garage as their office to build the search engine. She eventually went on to lead YouTube and was there as an employee for a number of years and eventually the chief executive officer. Sundar Pichai, Google's chief executive officer, said, "She is as core to the history of Google as anyone, and it's hard to imagine the world without her." Susan Wojcicki was born to parents Stanley and Esther. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Stanley and Esther. Stanley was born in Poland, and he and his brother fled from Poland to Sweden with his mother when the communists came to power. His father remained in Poland and was imprisoned for 5 years for being a member of the government's main opposition party. He was never able to get a visa to come to the U.S. Stanley Wojcicki studied mathematics, went to Harvard and Berkeley, and got a Ph.D. He worked at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and was a National Science Foundation Fellow at CERN, and that is the largest particle physics laboratory in the world. Okay. He recommended building this superconducting super collider, in which they started, and they put $4 billion into it in the 1980s in Texas, and then it was abandoned. Congress voted to not continue funding it. I think some money went missing, but anyway, that's her father. Her mother is a well-known teacher and has won many awards for her teaching. And it goes on to tell you all of this. But she has been called the godmother of Silicon Valley. So one thing that is said about Susan Wojcicki and her family, it says the Wojcicki family became known as something close to Silicon Valley royalty. Wojcicki's sister Anne is the founder and CEO of genetics testing company 23andMe. Isn't that interesting? That's where you send your sample and they tell you who your great-great-granddaddy was. And everybody just loves to find that out. Anne, the founder and CEO of genetics testing company 23andMe, was once married to Google co-founder Brin. And finally, Susan's mother, Esther, wrote a book, I don't know when, not too long ago, entitled How to Raise Successful People: Simple Lessons to Help Your Child Become Self-Driven, Respectful, and Resilient. Evidently, there is another sister there besides Susan and Anne. So the third sister, Janet, is a doctor of anthropology, pediatrics, and epidemiology. So three very successful women, and that is what, I guess, inspired the mother to write the book. What is interesting, though, you're looking at Silicon Valley royalty. And the mother is said to have inspired Steve Jobs. What I'm hoping to point out for everyone, but specifically for Americans, we are always told that we don't have a class system. But I think our new class, let's not look at politicians, because we really know, don't we, by now, that they're not in charge. I think that we're better off looking at our tech overlords. And so when we look at these people, from Musk on down, going by the list of world's richest people, I almost think we can use that list as who are our enemies. And we have to become, all of us, better at identifying our enemies. Because just as Esther Wojcicki wrote a book about raising, you know, how to raise successful children, we too want our children, if we have them, and our grandchildren to become, I don't even know that successful is the right word, but we want them to be able to identify their real enemies. We don't want them caught up emotionally in a war or in politics, but to know who their real enemies are so that they have a fighting chance. I use this illustration in the book club video that I just posted earlier today. It's a quote from George Orwell. A people that elect corrupt politicians are not victims, but accomplices. So we know, because Alan has told us this for years and years, that we can't vote our way out of the problems that we're in. But we also can't go down and torch immigration, hotels where immigrants are being housed, or call for violence against them. Help your children and your grandchildren and those around you be able to identify who is the real enemy. Why are they your enemy? I hope that you all have a good week, and I'll be back later on with something else. Take care.
Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 2nd of August, 2020. As usual, I hope you're all doing okay under these incredible times in which we exist. I get lots of feedback from people who email me and tell me about their conditions in their countries and so on. And you always get a little taste of what's to come across the whole planet eventually, because you can't lock down a planet, a good chunk of the planet, and literally stop all commerce, almost all commerce. Pretty well forbid people to work, and then wonder why you're starting to get a shortage of food, you know. And South Africa, some articles there actually were sent to me, where they don't have much to start to live on anyway to begin with, but they're already had people dying of starvation, yeah. And that's going to happen elsewhere pretty rapidly, because you're living through an amazing time of a planned agenda by a truly global government that really exists. If you don't understand that, really, what you see on television or the clips on your internet, what you're seeing, they're not the bosses. They're a higher management level above politics, obviously. But they're not the bosses for the whole planet here. But the whole planet's on board with it, you see. And of course they do have these setups, these World Health Organizations as an example, through the United Nations. And the WHO is pretty well three quarters funded, at least three quarters by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So you can scrub that out for anything that's factual or scientific. Gates has an incredible agenda because his daddy was involved in the same kind of things, and eugenics, etc. So, you know, sinister characters, definitely, but they're not the bosses. The old system of having bosses at the very, very top are the fact that the bosses don't work. As such, they comment occasionally, but they don't take the heat for what their decisions cause on the general populations ever down through time, actually. And they have the bee. One of the symbols is the bee, of course, and the structure of the beehive. That's the Royal Society. The very first thing they brought out at the Royal Society, it was a glass pyramid. Inside it was a beehive, to represent the perfect society which they would structure through sciences. Most folk think it's just a some kind of independent scientific club just for chit-chat and sharing ideas. It's beyond that. They're all selective masons initially, and powerful people through finance and so on. But they also wanted to direct society and shape the course of the destiny of societies across. They were very selective, in fact, for a long time, who their members would be. And it wasn't something you could just ask to join. And that's how the world really is run. But the perfect society was basically modeled on a beehive idea. Napoleon had the same thing too, a very high mason too. And you all know probably if you've read in the documentation about him, he went into, when he went to into Egypt, of course, with a big army, which he left behind primarily and left them all to take the heat. But the fact is, he went into the Great Pyramid in Giza and was in for quite a while, and he came out with his, this was a big thing with top masons at the time. If you just lay in a sarcophagus and you get this instant revelation and so on and be a different person. And he made a cloak made for him, and they used some of the golden bees that had been taken out of one of that's one of the graves actually in Egypt, to represent the perfect society again. So here is a guy who's wore across a good part of Europe, and was intended to unify Europe. Interesting, it's almost the same kind of thing. Unify, isn't it? You unify Europe, and people like himself would be the magicians behind it. You see, the real rulers, the natural rulers, with a little help from their friends. And so he had his cloak made with these bees. All around the cloak. You keep getting, you live in a world of symbology, and most folk don't quite get what they see. And the signs and the gestures you get on pretty well everything you'll see from people who work in mid-management levels on television, representing organizations that claim they run the world. But you're loaded everywhere you look with these signs and their symbols, of course. And the folk just don't get it, do they? Because it's so common, it's everyday occurrences. And yeah, they go ooh and ah when they look into the Super Bowl and things like that, and they watch these occultic ceremonies. No, they're not made by the dancers. You know, the dancers literally do what they're told to, well-paid promotions and all that. But you'll see all the occultic symbology displayed every time you look at the thing, and the transitioning of society and humans themselves into other beings, always under the guise of progressive science and so on, progressive knowledge, and the implementation of progressive knowledge. It's quite something you watch, but it's boring as well to me in a way, because you know what it all represents and is meant to represent, and it's really not a high messaging for the public. But you'll see all these things all the time, over and over and over, and it does get boring. It really does. You're living in a world completely different than the one that exists, because you've been trained to see it differently from birth. And Jack C. Lull, really, really good philosopher, talked about that the idea of propaganda and how it truly works, and how you have to train a child very early for subsequent propaganda to take effect on them. And he said the initial technique of indoctrinating a child to listen and just accept was so important. If it didn't get that initial indoctrination, subsequent indoctrination wouldn't take on them as he got older. It wouldn't work. So that was always understood from a very early time, because there's nothing new in controlling millions or even billions of people. These are very old sciences indeed. And there's never been a time when all of these sciences are really interconnected now, specialized segments of them. To do with the mind and humanity and sociology and anthropology, etc. It's all combined today. And so much so that even the military, the military, especially the U.S. and the Chinese militaries, they take anthropologists along with them when they go into other countries, either to take the countries down or to help them, which is the same thing. They take them down by big smiling faces, and then they dish out cash, and then they manage you, and they give you little hospitals and schools, and they get involved in education, and before you know it, they've turned it into another little indoctrination school for themselves to manage the peasantry better. These are well understood, and most folk really don't know. They really haven't a clue. So many of the big, massive charities you look at are not there for the reasons that you think that they're part of, really. The military-industrial complex, a lot of them. And that's why there's no real check on where the cash goes, except occasional expose of millions disappearing here and there and everywhere, etc. But whenever you hear charity, it's like mum's apple pie, because you've been trained that way. And if you were to complain about mum's apple pie, you must be a terribly bad person. Yeah? Yet USAID, for instance, and these helpful humanistic foundations and so on, they're part of it. They dish out the cash and some of the training in some of these countries they want to take over for resources. And that's how things are. War is not seldom anything. Well, we don't go to war to help people. We don't go to war to even free people. We go to war to take over the resources of nations. And you don't get any of it. You'll do all the fighting. You get handed the bill for it. And you'll be given simple propaganda, total lies of why you're doing it. But the ones behind you who already own your country, and I mean own, are the ones who get all the profits from all the raw resources and so on that come along. And that's the real world. It's vastly, vastly different, as I say, from the one that you're given. The US, for a little while, a short period, had some hope. Newborn countries have some hope when they're still riding on the backs of what they thought was a revolution to give them individual rights and freedoms. Very important, individual, you see. And basic rights to property and things like that, which they really didn't. Nothing was safe in Europe if you're lower people and lower levels of the class system. Nothing was safe at all that you had, even the farming. But we saw that even in Russia, where small plot farmers that still kept the country going collectively, when you put them all together, what they produced, it kept the country going. There were small independent families and so on. Were pretty well wiped out and starved to death when the Bolsheviks took over. And they lost everything. And then the state pretending to take it over and run all. But there's nothing, as I say, that's presented to you that's exactly as I say it is. With the American idea, yes, you got all the crooks running into the States as soon as they heard, oh, you know, you can exploit this country, there's so little, and it's true, so few laws and regulations at the time in the early days. And it's also understood and taught, of course, in sociology that the reason that the U.S. is sinking now is it caught up and surpassed the bureaucracies with massive civil services and government agencies and state agencies who all implement stacks and stacks of rules and regulations until you can't afford to do anything and start to prosper. That's how that was all done intentionally, too. So corruption always sets in, but for a while, there was an optimism in the US, and it also seeped in to the individuals in the US, regardless of class, because they were left alone for a while. You didn't have to pay taxes. I mentioned that before, that taxes came in really to help to start off. They called it the temporary war tax or the victory tax for America. And that was taxing your income. And back in the 90s, I gave talks on the history of the tax, the income tax in America and elsewhere. And Effie on too, she's an elderly woman who'd lived through the Great Depression. She said how bad it was. You know, they were a little plot farm themselves, like many folk in America. And, the U.S. at one time, and this is what Jefferson said too, it only remained free if everybody had the ability to feed themselves, even one cow or so, and a little field or whatever to grow their food. He said once that was taken away from people, you were under some kind of tyranny, and he was quite right on it too. So these are basic things for life. Now they give you the idea of massive profits if you get away from all of that and go into the high business and high, all that kind of stuff. But when things crash, you're back to square one again. Now how can you feed yourself? And so on, you see. And apart from that, as I say, the sharks ran into America like you wouldn't believe, from all over the world, and the scam artists, the conologists. And I gave talks on conology years ago, and it's the art of the great con, and how it works, and how you must participate in your own fraud, basically. You're getting defrauded or you're getting robbed without knowing it. But you must, it's like The Sting, the movie The Sting, things like that. You must participate in being fooled. And you go along with it. That's the same as voting. You know, you actually, most folk who vote really think they're going to change something. As I've said before, if voting was real, which it would be if you had a real society and people were real and politicians were real, and they meant what they said, and they had the best interests of the public at heart, then yeah, it certainly would. But if it ever was real, it was gone long, long ago. And Carol Quigley mentioned that in Tragedy and Hope, his book. And he was a member of the society that at least was a recruiting agency for the management of the U.S. on behalf of those who really ruled it. And he said that every president, and even prime ministers across the world, in different certain countries, had been part of chosen and pre-selected by the organizations, regardless of party, before they get into office. This one organization with its own tenets and goals and ideals and so on. And he was no conspiracy nut. I mean, he taught university. He also taught at, wasn't this Georgetown University? He taught stacks and stacks of bureaucrats and people who would be working in the Foreign Office for the U.S. State Department and so on. And across the world as diplomats. So he was up there. He knew what he was talking about. And, well, that's again a sideline again too. I could go on forever about him, but what I'm saying is the U.S. was taken over pretty quickly. Once you got to World War One, they'd already had techniques a little. You have bumps in the road as you're being trained to need something. I've mentioned predictive programming before over the years, and it's a common usage now. But what they do is they give you events. And entertainment too, of course. Most of your entertainment is loaded with predictive programming. How you should feel about this and feel about that and think about this and etc. And what you should like or what you should condemn is all full of that and how you should be. And you lap it up, now realizing you're getting brainwashed, and you wonder where your opinions came from. Maybe as you get a bit older, hopefully you will. But predictive programming, it also comes out from newspapers, which of course the elite have always owned. You must get uniformity of information, and which gives uniformity of opinion. So then it's easy to control people when they all have the same opinions because you've given it to them. And so they always give you a right-wing paper in every place, every area, and a left-wing paper. It's generally a sun, or it's a star. You see, one or the other, or a Mercury and so on. But it's always one or the other that they give you, and folk will pick it. Well, my dad read that, so I'll read this one, and I'll vote that way too. Very easy, very simple. And of course, the talks that they gave years ago at the Rockefeller Institute, basically, when they were taking over all the industry of the U.S. through different sub-companies and so on. they decided to how many newspapers we need. And they, other ones that, that spun off from the Rockefellers did the same kind of thing. But initially they said about 30 odd, maybe 32, 33 newspapers across the country and magazines. And I think Quigley touched on that too. He said that, that for every, even for the civil service, they had magazines that were very flashy, glossy magazines for women and men, you see, in the civil service. And that would cater to them and give them their ideas and what they should think about events and so on. Everybody's catered to, very much so. And so you really don't have true free opinions. And generally, when you're not under stress, you'll never realize that you're getting, it's not forced opinion, it's a uniformity of opinion. It's selected and mandated to put across articles that all seem to be from this author or that author, and so it must be all independent. And it just coincidence they're all agreeing about the same things, and everywhere you look, you know, to read. That's how it's done. And of course, once movies came in, that took over and loaded the deck with propaganda. But with comparative programming, you can also get events. Because it's like the vaccine. It's like COVID, the great pandemic, as they say. You know, it's very much like that. In fact, to actually say that, I've read the articles before from the SAGE group and so on, and the subgroups hired by the UK of behaviourists and the BIT groups and so on, the nudge experts, you might say, who actually gave out handouts to the newspapers to tell them how to present news to the public in this so-called pandemic, and how to, the different stages of it, how to start it off and put fear into the public. And if they found not enough folk were complying and obeying what they were told to do, then they could hype up the fear. So in other words, terrify the public. That was the advice given by the governments, the agencies, through these particular behavioral and psychological groups that were using for brainwashing as well. Still on the go, yeah. Terrify the public, literally cause terror amongst the public to get compliance. Well, again, predictive programming, back in the 19th century, the characters who came in, we know who some of them were, into the US, were quite open about the fact that they'd love to get a centralized system for the economy and run it and own it, of course. And so there's about some of them were bankers and some of them also lent money to nations, in fact, even back then. Got together, and long before Jekyll Island came along, and gave up these little predictive programming stunts, you see, to get the public to demand something. And so it caused crashes. So three of them got together, and they caused the crashes in the late 1800s, two of them at least. And I know that Gould was one of them, and I think J.P. Morgan might be another. But they got together, just like a Soros operation. These are old techniques where Soros boasted in the British newspapers how he'd crashed basically the British economy at one point. And he said they called up to his friends and they arranged it together and they did it and got away with it. No one arrests them because they're too, way above any, they're up there. They're working for the real owners of the planet, you see. And he boasted about it quite happily of how they did it. And as I said, the country had to borrow millions and millions of pounds to try to float the economy again. They screw folk over and over and over, these characters, with impunity. Yeah, complete, just like the 2008 crash, complete impunity. It's incredible. But anyway, back to the late 1800s. And so the idea was to get the public to say, oh, look, we can't go on like this with different banks having their own cash and some of them with their own currency even, but we can't go on. We need a centralized system. And so what you must always, just like the vaccine thing, get the public to be terrified and demand it. Get them to demand what you want them to demand. And then you say, well, it just happens. This so happens. We have a plan, you see. And so the same thing happened in time for World War I, where they brought in the income tax to fund The same guys who, under President Wilson, they brought in the Federal Reserve System. And they also brought in the income tax in 1917 or so to fund the money, to pay back the money that would get borrowed by the government for the war when they were going to get involved with it. Part of the reason they got in too in the US was to make sure that the countries they'd been, they'd been lending to from the US across Europe would be able to pay it all back. This is what it's all about, folks. Is the US didn't go to World War I for altruistic reasons. It was to make sure that all the loans were secured, and with the Treaty of Paris they came out with eventually after the big conference that they had in 1919, they gave a bunch of the characters who were the money lenders themselves, or representatives of them, the power to decide who was going to pay what, to pay back all the loans for the war. They dumped a lot in Germany, of course, completely unable to pay it all back, so that helped to lead to World War II. That's a different story again. But the point is, they always get the public to demand what they want you to demand. And say, what's that you say? We demand you centralize this, the money system, and make it, because it's all so corrupt and it keeps folding all the time and we go bankrupt. And really, well, I don't know if we can do that for you. Well, maybe we could set up an institution maybe. And so they set up the private banking system called the Federal Reserve. It sounds awfully important, eh? And yet it's really a foreign bank, in a sense, or a series of them, often employing foreigners to run this system for the American citizenry. It's astonishing, really. But that's no different than what ran Britain for centuries and still does in the City of London. So, as I say, the predictive program is awfully important. To get the public literally to demand what they want you to demand. Save us, that's the cry, you see. We can't go on like this. And okay, but well, there's conditions here. We can help float the economy again, but the tax system is going to get brought in to pay off the money that you're going to be borrowing from us. And of course, that's usury. And usury, one time for labor, was completely illegal. And that was hashed out in Wilson's time when they tried to bring it in for World War I. The actual paying of income taxes, because labouring, again, taxation of labour was illegal. That had been the way for centuries, actually, in different countries. Mind you, they can always get it from 100 different other ways, through fees, they call it fees. Your countries now are loaded up with fees for this and fees for that and licensing for this and lots of licenses and fees. So it's a distaxation, of course. And if you pay your fee, in other words, it's like a license, for a driving license. You get fined and charged, maybe put in prison if you don't have a license to drive. If you pay money and you get a license, then it's okay to do something that's otherwise illegal. That's the difference. You've paid money, now you can legally drive. Yeah. And many other things that are very similar to that too. So yeah, the US at one time was vivacious to an extent, as life, had a lot of life in it. Canada had that at one time too. I think it was dying off with Pierre Trudeau, because he brought in massive international socialism, because he was beyond just socialism. But up until the 1970s, the US and Canada were the places to be, because even the working class too still had this idea of optimism. But in the late 70s, it started to die off, and as economies were stagnating, and again, the big corporations were putting factories now across the world, different cheaper labor area markets, of course. And then, of course, they start to inflate the currency, and in the process, they devalue the purchasing power. So you need more and more paper to pay for the same amount of goods until you're running backwards. And we've been like that for an awful long time. That was all intentional, because I've never, ever, ever... You understand, the system that runs us all is not for us. It's not for us. It never was. the conologists who run the banking industry, the true international banking industry at the top, and the World Bank, for instance, and the IMF, and the Bank for International Settlements were all constructs of what were set up, but really globalists. They were for world enterprise, for real, true world federalism, as long as they ruled it all, you see. And that's, again, that goes into, you can go to Carl Quigley again to get your ideas and roots from that one. Empire was the idea, world empire. Hasn't changed. And you will find out that the Great Reset they're talking about is the culmination for this time in history to bring it all into full worldwide effect, with themselves again at the top running the whole show, with a massive global bureaucracy of civil servants. And many of them are private corporate civil servants, but just they're just the same. Some big corporations have more civil servants working for them, for their own corporation, than some governments do. It's not uncommon. And you look at the World Economic Forum itself and look at how many employees they have, thousands and thousands of them. And they have whole departments for educating their leaders, future leaders across the world. And really, they're like political social leaders that will keep you going with the idea they've got democracy, but in reality, that they're trained by those who already rule the world. And the world is ruled. But yes, as I say, it's an awful shame. You can see it in the old movies too, before they were totally contaminated and loaded. Because in the old movies, and some of them were silly comedies and so on, but silly and happy at the same time. There's that optimism. It's all gone now. It's all gone completely. And now it's very, and Canada's even worse, because Canada's been, was socialistic long ago. It was taken over long ago for socialism. And even when, Gozenko wrote his book on about the fall of a titan, to do with the fact of the civil servant, that the federal civil service in Canada being loaded with communist, card-carrying communists at the time, at the end of World War II, that didn't die off or go away by any means at all. So Canada was heavily, heavily loaded to this whole idea of socialism. And socialism too means many different things to different people. It's meant to be that way. It's meant the people that at the bottom think socialism is going to be more fair, and especially when you're in the middle class or lower middle class or working classes. I've got a safety net there. If I ever need a safety net, this socialism will take care of me. No, it's not. It's so-called a social science of how to run the world, how to run collectivist societies, and how to get it, make them efficient, very efficient. That's the idea, right down to getting both partners out, and if they have any partners at all, both out working in the workforce, and as a stage to dissolution totally of the family unit, of course. And a new type of family unit, which will be supplied by the state, which has already happened to an extent. And science pops in, and well, we're taking that over too, you see. It's, it all comes together. However, I mean, socialism had a lot of followers in the 1930s and 40s and 50s even, because it still gave the preaching, deceptive preaching, we're here for ordinary folk, and to give you safety nets if you got unemployed and things like that. But the science way above it was declared in the early 20th century, openly by the Fabian Society, if you care to look into it. And George Bernard Shaw, he said that the working man, for instance, thinks that he's going to get more income to take home to his family, and more guaranteed income where he can look ahead and maybe purchase more items, or even if you, the Fabians didn't want you to own property. They want the state to own the property. The state, of course, like everything else, farms it out to private corporations, big corporations. Yeah. And so you can bring in the same thing. You say, well, it can't be socialism because, you know, there's big chains of corporate owners now in real estate that rent out across the world, and they do have that But no, it's the same folks that brought you Fabianism. So they could have almost total ownership across big cities of vast swaths of property. You'll never get your head around it. The folk who manage money, it's almost genetic with them. They're obsessed with how to make more all the time. And how to get round ways of all the obstacles that are put in their path with optimism. They're very optimistic, and but they're obsessed with money all the time. But the ones above them that have all the money, they have all the money. They'll never go bust. The ones above them all, and that's the key to it. Everyone gets stuck in their own level of indoctrination. And most of them never figure out their entire lives that they're under this kind of system, you know. You look at the different gangsters that run cons, big cons on society. And they're often, I can remember Bernie Madoff, when the 2007-8 collapse happened and his massive Ponzi scheme came down. But there were articles out there how everybody knew him in the big city, the Big Apple and all that. And how your doors opened, literally opened for him, like servants almost bowing to the guy, and he didn't have to open doors and so on, like he was, and that's how these characters live. And you know, it was a castle in the air. As long as folk kept coming in to invest money, they could keep the con going longer and longer, but not forever. And, eventually it fell. But so they love this kind of, feeling of supremacy over others. And unfortunately, the problem with most folk, the ordinary folk, the bottom two that like doormen in hotels, they will grovel to characters who have this kind of cash. It's a sad thing, isn't it? People often say, and the communists will tell you that, even the Antifa groups now, all these people just kowtowing to people who have been statues, who had all this cash and power. Well, nobody forced them to kowtow, you see. It's inhuman, unfortunately, in human nature. Just like the Antifa communists would kowtow to a reincarnation of Lenin today, you know, or Trotsky. And they would, immediately, they grovel, here, that's their god in earth, you see. It's the same with Rockefellers, when old Rockefeller had the military or the militia turn on the miner strikers in the tent cities at one time. And they opened fire on these tents and wiped out a lot of the miners and their families. That's when they brought in the idea of, let's turn him into a do-gooder. He's not a mean, terrible robber baron type character. No, he wants to help society and make it better for you, you see. So they created very quickly, and it all shows you using the Bernays type characters, who understood human nature awfully well. The idea of propaganda again, and reinvent Rockefeller as a philanthropist. And since then, once they did that, they could take over so many massive businesses and big pharma groups. We're here to help you. We're here to help you. And I remember that it was a book called The Rockefellers, I think, and it mentions that not long after the shooting, when they very quickly set up this big philanthropy, using public relations experts at that time, in that day and age. It was already well advanced, obviously, and one of them was called Gates, by the way, and the other one was Mackenzie King of Canada. They made him a prime minister eventually as a reward. But so they reinvented Rockefeller as a great philanthropist. And they said that for one big PR stunt, they brought around miners' homes, or their shacks, really. And they all knew it was done, and all the cameras were there, and they all knew it was being done for public relations. But as soon as you got in the doors of some of the miners, they could see them slumping, almost bowing, you know, literally looking down in the presence of someone of such, it was kind of disgusting and shameful and sad. Sad statement about humanity. Not long after, the guy had literally told militias to wipe out families like that. But that's how you do it. If you understand human nature, it will react. Again, back to Plato, you know the formulas, and you can reduce the same systems if you understand the sequence of introduction and implementation. Sad, isn't it? Very sad. And I've always said it's not a good thing to worship people, human living people. It's not a good thing. You'll always end up in disaster, you know. But the sad thing is most folk, and especially in an atheistic society, that's why they had to destroy religions, because in a totally atheistic society, they'll worship humans. And they'll create them for you. Oh, so-and-so is a genius. This man is a multi-billion dollar genius. And it's all fake and all that. But you'll believe it, and many of them will grovel, absolute grovel, to get near these people, you know? Like they're magically, you know, powerful magic, very similar to kings and queens in the Middle Ages and even later Middle Ages, and it wasn't unusual for in England too for people to try and touch the cloak of a royalty, even when a relative of the higher royalties, they try to touch their clothing, hoping it would rub off on them, this magic from the blue bloods that had been appointed by God, you see. So nothing changes. So if you don't have that part of it, then you simply have the person who invented the doctrine, or who was a high priest of the doctrine, as in Marxism, etc. And they will worship them. And you always get psychopaths, or I don't care what kind of system is, psychopaths who gravitate around the people who are powerful, because they want to power as well, and money for themselves. So that's how it works. So if you start worshipping human beings, you're in trouble, because psychopaths, it will be these particular human beings, and definitely the ones around them, they're going to be managing you. Very sad, isn't it? And it's no different what I'm talking about here than don't look for instant fixes in society. That's part of what I'm saying too. Because you won't get it. Humans that rule over other peoples, I don't care what kind of system or democracy or fascism or communism, it's always the same types of people who run you. And if they're rather blatant themselves, blatantly nasty and power hungry, they simply employ those in academia. That's worldwide now. Whole levels of them in specialized areas, and pay them awfully well to do the running for them and to advise them. You see, that's how it's done. And you dress psychopaths up in nice suits. You don't build up into uniforms, military uniforms. That was for the 30s, that era. No, after that, you put them in really nice suits and ties. And they're well groomed, and you might even give them basic elocution lessons if they have to give any talks to the public, or little quips. As long as they read their scripts, they're fine. Most of the things you get today are all through public relations experts. Most of the articles that you're given. And when you've got an official, like a politician, having to say something for a PR shot, it's already given the script. Even for a one-line sentence, it's not spontaneous. That's how fake everything is today. So getting back to, you know, George Bernard Shaw declaring what socialism was, it was for a technocratically run society, an expertly run society. Everything would be ruled by experts for efficiency's sake. And science would be a big, big part of it. That's what you saw in Things to Come, in the movie, the version of Things to Come by H.G. Wells. You'd have the Freemasons of the air, the scientific elite would come across after this massively destructive war that destroyed nations as such, till you had little city-states or towns doing their own things, and the Freemasons of the air and their super-advanced military machines would then gas them all and take over the world and unify the world with themselves at the top, running it all scientifically. And their offspring would be doing exactly the same kind of thing, but under the guise of what they call progressive nature of the system. They would always advance science. That'd be the pinnacle of everything, and whoever science dictated, those all down, all the strata beneath them would have to go along with it. Bernard Shaw was more Bolshevik about it, where he said that. He says, we're not here to help you, meaning the peasantry. He says, you know, because you can do what they tell you, or you won't get food at all. And you have to work, by the way. You know, they weren't in there for charity in communism. You had to work. No work, no food, you know. So you had to work, and Shaw pretty well said the same kind of thing. So was H.G. Wells for the same kind of system. But Shaw was blatant about it, and that audio clip still out there yet, not a little video clip actually, where he says, yeah, you'll have to come to us and explain why we should keep you alive. Because the only reason you would be alive in communism-socialism is to serve the state, the system. You see? That's your purpose. Never changes. But they always need lots and lots of people to do the overthrows for them. It's quite fascinating, if you've got time at all. I'm sure lots more folk are going to have time than more than ever before for a little while, as you're all locked down and they destroy the economy of the world, really, by locking us all down. That's the intention of it. That's the real intention behind it, to bring in the new system. So you're going through a revolution with signs at the top, you see. And they're already showing they've got revolutionaries out there for the streets. If you fail to obey them, they'll turn them on you, you see. To heighten the fear amongst the general population. And it's not by accident at all. None of it's by accident at all. And none of it's independent of the whole big picture either. So, you're all being trained to demand help and, you know, save us. And you will, and you'll get your vaccination. And lots a damage will happen because of, I've no doubt on that at all. Especially with, they're all pretty bad, especially when they rush through all kinds of, without any testing. And then the fudging of data. It's bad enough, incredible fudging of data to try and get COVID deaths up by statistics. So that everybody who dies of anything is put down as COVID. And then that's not far-fetched. And by the way, for every one that they'll test with faulty tests to begin with that will come up positive, they'll attack about 50, at least 50 non. It's all computer-driven. Well, how many people would average person meet in a week, you know, maybe 15, it spits out the computer. So they just tack that on anyway. It's just all bogus. But the intention, remember, is to bring in a new system, the Great Reset, the Global Great Reset from the World Economic Forum, the masters. And they will. You're going to get rationing. I've said that years ago. Their intention was eventually to bring in rationing over 20 years ago. And here you are, you lead up to it, you can't go on and on. And people wonder where these tin cans come from, or the meat comes from, or their porridge comes from, you see. So it's all magic to most folk who live in the whole, they're already under the thumb of the system, completely dependent on the system, you see. And that's what they want you to be, of course. And it's just starting. This is to last into all of next year, and maybe for 3 years. But the effects of it will never go away because it's to be a completely. They've said it at the World Economic Forum, and it really does match the stuff from George Bernard Shaw. You wait and see, you know. You wait and see what they introduce right down from the climate activism and climate changes to the group of what they call themselves, the Council. That meets for the climate change. Same people who run the World Economic Forum at the top, you know, who admitted that the folk were ignoring all their demands that you live a different way and come into austerity, etc., post-consumerist society, and living on the edge. That's what austerity is. So it's just, you know, it's the poverty line. That's where they want to take you. Post-production, post-consumerism, that comes next. And completely depend on their system for your very, very basic needs, you know. That's what they want to bring in. So it goes along the way of the socialism, you see. including their statements. Quite fascinating to read them, of the redistribution of wealth to make the people at the bottom join the revolution. And it's a big, big lie. Here's the richest folk who run and own now the world's wealth and its resources, pretending that they're going to redistribute. No, no, they're going to bring the true technocracy through forward in a complete rationing system with conditions. Everything's got conditions of behavior and compliance. For everything you're told to do and comply with, you better do, or you won't get your little rationing or your universal basic income, etc., etc. I really mean, this is not speculation. They wrote about this in the 1940s. And Bertrand Russell, again, was one of them. He worked with all of the different groups. He was a member of the Macy Group, and he worked even with the Frankfurt School eventually. And he worked with under presidents and prime ministers to design a post-World War II culture for the public, leading to the changes step by step of, again, it was always the same thing, dissolution of the family unit, population reduction would come from that, and all other things too, which you're pretty well familiar with. Quite fascinating, really. And we're living through it now, though. It's not things to come, it's here. And you're seeing it unrolled. So yeah, the predictive programming is all around you. Horrific stories, terror stories, backed up by just figures and data and statistics. You see, that are all fudged to terrify. With behavior is screaming, oh, 10,000 more cases today. Well, if they just unleashed another 50,000 tests in that area the day before or the week before or whatever. Well, yeah, you'll get more coming up with faulty tests anyway. But the fact is, these are not folk in hospital or who are sick. If you understood how many viruses go through your system all your whole life long, and through the entire population, some of them can sweep through in a matter of a few weeks, through the entire population, and you'll never know it because no one's sick in them. That's quite normal. And this is the cons, again, back to conology, that's what they're doing. And you must participate in the con voluntarily. But you're doing it because they terrify you, so technically it's involuntarily. You've been petrified into compliance. And that's what they said they do and with the SAGE groups and then the subgroups that work for them on behalf of the British government. And how they would step up the hype to get more and more fear to get compliance from the public. There you go, demanding that the media lie to you. The media doesn't need much persuasion, mind you, but when they're getting well paid for it. They're getting more funding now than they've had for years because no one was reading newspapers and so on, or and even looking at their sites for their news because it's all nonsense and celebrities, you see. They're all getting big handouts and fund bailouts and funding, you see, as essential services to brainwash you and to lie to you on behalf of the masters to try to get a uniform route of implementation that everyone's going to follow, you see. And again, isn't it so beautiful, the techniques that they've used? It is. If you're looking at a movie with evil characters in the movie, you have no problem understanding what I'm talking about. But because, you mean, they can't all be so evil. Yes, they can. Humanity is very devious. Incredibly devious. And the people who are going to certain areas are more devious than anybody else. You know, the higher up in governmental levels and corporation levels, all they do is sit and scheme how to get more and how to manipulate and how to take. And how to demolish competition all the time as well. You know, the billions of dollars that go into all your intelligence agencies every year. Billions and billions, multiple billions of dollars in every country. Is to find ways to scheme and to lie and to deceive other nations and their own people by different techniques and so on, and by persuasion and lies and so on, so that those who own you can take more from you or take more resources from countries. That's why you go to war with countries. It's all economic. Marx was right in that. That war is at the root of all the wars is economics. It's materialism. Stealing, you know. Yeah. We steal it because we want it. But for the public, you must demonize the people. That they're led by this terrible maniac over there who's nasty to his own people. And very simple propaganda. And the simpler the better. If it's too complex, you can pick it apart. So keep it simple. And Saddam Hussein was just a terribly bad man. He was killing thousands of his own people all every year, you know. So to save the people, we have to go over and starve them out initially with a total embargo, kill 500,000 of them that you're saving, right? Through the State Department. You all know who was in it at the time. It's all through the news. I did the talks years ago on the radio on it. But yes, 500,000 women and children alone were starved to death before they had the war start. And Madeleine Albright was questioned about that in a TV program. Did you think it was worth it, starving all those folk? Oh, yes, I think it was worth it, she said. Well, there's a psychopath right there. You honestly can't really fit her into the category of human. I can't. Really, I can't. There was no trace of emotion or regret or nothing. No, same with Tony Blair. I said, we'd do anything different again. Oh, no, I wouldn't do anything again differently at all. The biggest, one of the biggest liars that brought Britain into the same kind of war. Yeah, this is total corrupt. We're living in total corruption. But again, it's chronology. We must comply with the corruption to make it work. Huh? We supply the troops for the wars. All young guys will believe what they're told. They can't believe they live in a monster country. Actually, that's changed since the advent of games, video games of all kinds. They've trained a whole generation not to think about rights and wrongs for the reasons you're killing and slaughtering people. You just want to go there and rack up points to an extent. But before that, they had to really give you, this is why you're doing. And it would make sense to you. During the Cold War, lots of young folk would join the military. And they'd also go off and fight in different faraway lands, etc. Believing, a lot of them were believing it and what they were told it was all for, or having faith at least that those above in your country had good reasons for doing it. And the sad part is, the ones above you did have good reasons for doing it. They profited from it. That was a good reason from it, you see. Sad, isn't it? But corruption in society is phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal, and it's shameless. They're shameless at the top in all the countries, and we do live in a more of a psychopathic era. And don't forget, psychopaths give you when they rule your country. Eventually, if they get what they want, was an atheistic population. Psychopaths have an awful time fighting, and so did the communists. Call it what you want, totalitarians, tyrannies. They have a hard time trying to fight those who are religious, so they have to outlaw, slaughter all the religious, or ban them completely, because when the folk have something they believe in to stand up for, they're far more dedicated to it and willing and energized to overthrow tyranny. Than if they're atheists themselves. If they're atheists, they won't do it. So like, no, won't. So the atheists can be manipulated much more easily. But when psychopaths are in control, you see, they've eliminated all competition. Like the big idea theory, they're terrified of the big idea. In fact, they stole the big idea, like Bush Sr., he said that too. A big idea, he says. A new world order, yeah. And Mao Zedong said the same thing, Mao. The big idea was the only thing that made him afraid. At that time, he was talking of folk who had a real religious cause, because they're unstoppable when they get going. And they know this. So when psychopaths rule you totally in an atheistic society, they have no problem recruiting youngsters and paying them well, like mercenaries, to go out off and slaughter. It's much easier to do it because they give you a psychopathic culture. That's one of the symptoms of the fact you're conquered when they give you a psychopathic culture. And so folk are not necessarily completely psychopaths will follow it too and follow, have a lot of the traits of them, but they're not truly psychopaths. And that's how we are today. Most folk who run up to the top worship the psychopathy success stories.